So let's go ahead and talk about
Judd
the
Apatow.
Subject of this episode.
Judd Apatow.
The great, George Carlin.
The great Judd Apatow. No, we changed to Judd Apatow, Paul.
It's Judd Apatow, dude.
We're doing Judd Apatow.
Did you get the memo? We sent you a memo.
Yeah, we sent you several texts about this.
I feel like he feels.
So Judd Apatow was born August 18th. What was it, 1954?
No, he's not that old. It's 1969.
Oh, Poughkeepsie, Illinois.
Yeah.
To Barbara and Walter Apatow.
Obviously.
Yes.
Why are you struggling to remember their last name? They have the same last name as their son.
I believe he has a Jewish heritage, TJ.
Yeah, he is a Jewish descent, not surprising. But he was actually not raised. He's not about Judd Apatow. It's about George Carlin. No one gives a fuck about Judd Apatow.
Thank fucking God.
No one gives a fuck about fucking Judd
Apatow. Oh, my God. I was so fucking salty that I was going to have to sit and listen to Judd Apatow.
We would never do an episode about Judd Apatow.
Oh, thank God.
I mean, maybe we would, but it wouldn't be what this is about to be. I am here to chew bubble gum and suck George Carlin's dick. And I'm all out of bubble gum. This is gonna be a real kiss-assy episode.
I mean, what can you do?
Yeah, I mean, I tried to find angles of like, well, you know, but I couldn't. He's just awesome. I love George Carlin. Much like with the Manson episode, I found the amount of shit that I know about these guys made it actually more hard to do the episode.
Right.
Because I mean, like, we could probably do a whole episode on, you know, George Carlin's childhood and have it be a fucking 2-hour, 3-hour episode.
Right.
George Carlin in the 60s could be an episode. George Carlin in the 70s could be an episode. George Carlin in the 80s, the 90s, towards the, you know, the 2000s, towards the end of his career. They could all be their own fucking episode, honestly. But we're not going to do all that. We're not going to go through all that shit. So how does one summarize the life and impact of George Carlin? The answer I've discovered trying to do this research is one doesn't. His career is just way too vast. His material is way too expansive. His impact is too incalculable. So what I can tell you in summary is that George Carlin was just the sort of once-in-a-lifetime genius, the likes of which you're probably just not going to see again. I don't expect to see another George Carlin in my fucking lifetime. I really don't. And I'm not saying that there's no one that has been as good as him or whatever, but I'm saying that there was a uniqueness to his perspective. The only person I can even really think that belongs in the same sentence that worked around the same times as him would be Bill Hicks, who obviously had a much shorter career due to his early death from pancreatic cancer.
Right.
Obviously, Richard Pryor, Bill Cosby.
So how did you
probably belong in
so
the same discussion?
You're the one that researched and created this episode. So what angle, if what you're saying is like, I can't really pick a common, you know, thread or theme. So it's just that he's just so unique. This is like a once in a fucking generation kind of person as far as mm-hmm. field of comedy is concerned.
Yeah. Few artists age like wine, Scotty.
Certainly you haven't.
Yeah, certainly not. Certainly not.
Bring back 2011 TJ.
2011 TJ is never coming back.
Well, George Carlin did, in fairness. I've heard, because I've done some research on him. I talked about his career. Like, he did hit low points in his career.
Oh, yeah, he had highs and lows.
People, obviously.
It wasn't all.
His shtick became
up
all
and
the
up
times.
And up and up and up and never end. It's just a nonstop ride
to
the top.
He wasn't a constant innovator. I mean, he had his high points and his low points.
Yeah, well, I mean, you know, we're talking about a guy. And that's one of the things that I want to focus on here is the fact that just the immensity of the career. Like, how many times have you heard it said of an artist or an entertainer, you know, their early stuff was better? How many times have you said it yourself?
All the time.
All the time. Oh, man, Nine Inch Nails, yeah. Oh, I love their early stuff.
Yeah.
You know, or, you know, Marilyn Manson, love his early stuff. Or, you know, whoever, this director. We can even say about Judd Apatow. Oh, yeah, I liked some of his early films.
Sure.
There's tons of artists that they have this big, boom, they hit the scene, they make their mark, and then they kind of fucking fade away like a fart.
You know, like the 80s rock band that makes the same album over again.
The 80s rock band that used to fill stadiums that now does, you know, 80s themed cruises or something.
The director that used to make art house fucking films that had mainstream appeal that's now just making, you know, basically summer blockbuster schlock for people.
Right. So with Carlin's, there's plenty of fans, myself included, that prefer his later stuff. It seemed like with each decade of his 52-year career in entertainment, he dug a little bit deeper into the essence of his being and the world around him to deliver something that was even more raw and real than he had before. So I think George Carlin is a rare example of an artist or an entertainer who aged like wine. Just got better and better over time, honed his craft to new levels, brought his fucking performance up, his writing up, everything. He just got better and better at
what
he did.
I mean, he stayed sharp throughout his entire life. I mean, some of the stand-up he delivered, even maybe a few years before he died,
the only person
top-notch.
I can think of on the Carlin level who maintained that kind of level of success in his field would probably be Bill Cosby, who had a slightly longer career at 57 years. But George Carlin never raped anyone as far as we know. So he's got that going
for him. He's got that going for him, yeah.
And, you know, when Bill was making family sitcoms and lecturing black people to pull up their pants, Carlin was delving into his most subversive material yet.
Also, George Carlin had more fashion sense than this.
That, you got that right.
I don't know. I think Cosby had his own look.
I mean,
going on.
Sure, but I mean, I don't know. I like George Carlin's look a little bit better. Just more stripped down.
Yeah, because he's white, huh, Scotty? Is that what it's about?
No,
it's all about whiteness.
Bill
for you,
Cosby
huh?
looks like your grandpa.
So Carlin's material really encompasses nearly every possible facet of human life, from you know little shit like finding a scab on your head to big stuff like there's a bit he does where there's like the entire universe is destroyed and then reborn and into a fucking multiverse of fantasy worlds for everyone's Uncle Dave.
The worship of Joe Pesci?
Yeah, Joe Pesci worship, the giant electron. You know, so he could look, he could really take a microscope to the world, or he could pan out and look at the totality of existence. Like, you never knew what level his routine was going to come from.
I think there's also always a fascination with language with George Carlin.
Oh, yeah.
And obviously, that was his big break, the seven things you can't say, you know, on TV or whatever.
We're going to talk about that pretty extensively later.
Sure.
But yeah, his language, he had a love of language. His father was was in advertising. His mother was kind of a wannabe aristocrat who made sure that he, you know, that she really instilled a language in him. Like, he tells stories about being sat at his mother's knee and being told things like, you know, look at this word, George. You see how this word cuts? You know, so he was really made to see, like, the power of language and look how this word works in this context and look how these words go together. Like, that was really instilled in him from a young age.
You see it in his material for sure.
A lot of his material, even
every
is
word
overtly
is carefully placed in his material.
So I thought we'd start off by looking at his impact on some of the other entertainers around him. So we could start with Ben Stiller, who said he had an amazing mind and his humor was brave and always challenging us to look at ourselves and question our belief systems while being incredibly entertaining. He was one of the greats. Judd Apatow, who this episode is not about, said, "Nobody was funnier than George Carlin. I spent half my childhood in my room listening to his records, experiencing pure joy, and he was as kind as he was funny." Chris Rock actually had probably one of the more insightful things to say, in my opinion. He said, "People always compare me to Eddie Murphy, Richard Pryor, or Bill Cosby, I guess because of the black thing, but I always thought of my biggest influence was George Carlin." He goes on to say, "George approached his comedy like a musician. Every couple of years, there'd be a new album and there'd be a new act. The reason most comedians suck is they get an act, they do the same act for the rest of their lives. That's 85% of comedians, no growth. They hang on to these jokes, and every year they become less funny. I'm talking big stars, not George Carlin. He was an artist like Bob Dylan, Prince, Salvador Dali, Jean-Michel Basquiat. I don't know who that is.
Jean-Michel Basquiat.
There you go. Our artist. I don't know who that is, by the way. He didn't sit on his laurels. He was like, I got work to do. And what an incredible body of work, man. He was bringing it to the end. No one in the history of the business has ever had that kind of edge that late in life. He was friends with the Alan Kings of the world, that generation. But his style is really more of someone of my generation, a younger, hipper guy. He was like the voice of eight generations."
Sure. I mean, that's some high praise. I don't know if I'd say he's the voice of eight generations, but, you know, you got to confer some respect to that opinion.
Let's take a look at Bill Maher talk about George Carlin on The Larry King Show.
You know, I bet you if he was here now, what he would be saying is, "Why do people say nice things when you die? That's the stupidest thing to do. They can't hear you. You know, I mean, he would be the one guy who would be taking issue with us all heaping praise upon him just because I'm dead.
Was he, in a sense, a role model to you, Bill? I mean, what did he
represent? More than anyone. More than any, absolutely. And look, I've said this many times. When I was a kid starting out, there was not many young comedians, hip comedians. You were saying right before we had on the air, you said you're too young to remember Carlin on Ed Sullivan.
Lenny Bruce had a major effect on Carlin.
I miss Lenny Bruce. And I still don't listen to him. I don't find him funny. I find him groundbreaking, and I think he paved the way for a lot of people, including myself. But George Carlin was funny, like laugh out loud, hurt your gut kind of funny. And when I was a kid looking at comedy for the first time, George Carlin, when we first saw him, was on Ed Sullivan with a skinny tie. You remember that, George Carlin? He was the clean-cut guy with clean material. Then he put out an album in 1971 called AM and FM. AM was the A side of the album. That was the old George Carlin clean suit. FM was the new George Carlin. Long hair, T-shirt, hippie, dirty material.
There's the young judge.
Yes. This was, to someone like me, this was the Holy Grail. This was the guy saying, I've shed that skin. I'm not the old clean guy. I'm going to take this in a different direction. This is why this man is, to me, on the top of the mountain, because he's the most fearless, and he changed where comedy went.
I have one more of these influence things. This is Louis C.K. before his disgrace.
Man, TJ, bring up a lot of very problematic people in this
episode. I'm going to take my headphones off and protest
Bill
for this
Cosby,
segment.
Bill Cosby, and now Louis C.K.
So let's hear Louis C.K. talk about it, and then we can kind of have a little bit of a roundtable discussion on what the influence of George Carlin was.
I hated my act. I've been doing the same hour of comedy for 15 years, and it was shit, I promise you. And I was working places like Chinese restaurants. And I'd do a show in a Chinese restaurant where they don't even know there's a show going to happen. They're there to eat. And all of a sudden you'd go, hey, everybody. And people are like, I'm eating. I don't want to be forced to sit in this.
That's so true.
So I was doing a Chinese restaurant called the Kowloon in Boston, in Saugus, Massachusetts. And I was sitting in my car after the show just feeling like This was all a big mistake. I'm not good enough. And I felt like my jokes were a trap. And I listened to a CD of George talking about comedy and the workshopping it and talking about it seriously. And the thing that blew me away about this fellow was that he just kept putting out specials. Every year there'd be a new George Carlin special, a new George Carlin album. They just kept coming, and each one was deeper than the next. And I just thought, how can he do that? And it made me literally cry that I could never do that. I was telling the same jokes for 15 years. So I'm listening, and they ask him, how do you do all this material? And I'm like, and I hear him, and he says, well, I just decided every year I'd be working on that year's special. And I'd do the special, and then I'd just chuck out the material. And I'd start again with nothing. And I thought, that's crazy. How do you throw away? It took me 15 years to build this shitty hour. If I throw it away, I got nothing. But he gave me the courage to try. And also, I was desperate. What the fuck else was I going to do? This idea that you throw everything away and you start over again. And I thought, well, okay, when you're done telling jokes about airplanes and dogs, and you throw those away, what do you got left? You can only dig deeper. Start talking about your feelings and who you are. And then you do those jokes and they're gone. You got to dig deeper. So then you start thinking about your fears and your nightmares and doing jokes about that. And then they're gone. And then you start going into just weird shit. Yeah, eventually you get to your balls. But there's a whole...
So this tribute section really, honestly, could go on and on and on, because
it's rare to find somebody that doesn't have heaps of praise.
I could show you Bill Cosby praising him, Richard Pryor praising him, tons of people just emphatic with endless fucking praise.
I mean,
just
effusive praise.
Carlin.
Where do you turn?
The point is, he was a fucking legendary.
Right.
There's no comic like him. He stood out from the crowd. Everyone around him he influenced. Yet, if you read his book, Last Words, you'll find out that he never really felt like he was part of the world of the comedians who eventually came to adore him. You know, when he when he rarely went out with all the comics, you know, to the diner or to the bar after the show to talk shop and hang out and smoke and joke and whatever the fuck else.
Was it because he was busy fucking writing material?
No, it was actually a little bit of insecurity on his part. The reason he states in his book is that he didn't feel like he was quick-witted like the other comics. He didn't feel like he had that natural sort of ability to pull funny out of his ass. So it made him feel kind of like insecure about it. And he didn't feel fundamentally on some level that he was doing the same thing that they were doing for whatever reason. You know, he felt like his approach was different. The kind of person that he was different. He didn't really, he was kind of not really much of a joiner. He didn't feel like he fit in anywhere. He always kind of wanted to be on his own, walking his own path, doing his own thing.
It sounded like he was never really as comfortable being part of a group. It's like he always had to have things the way he wanted them to be. And I'm sure part of the insecurity was based on, like, you know, if I get into this group, is it going to change me as a person?
Right.
Like, fundamentally, am I going to have to sell myself out so I can become part of this, you know?
Well, and there's also the influence on your work. If you're hanging around other comedians all the time, they're naturally, their sense of humor is going to bleed into your material, and maybe he didn't want that.
Right. And, you know, George Carlin had a very careful and scientific approach to his comedy, you know? Like, a lot of comedians, they're funny from the gut, I think. George Carlin was very much a thinking man's comedian. He would write a bit of material, which I'm sure had its origin there somewhere in the gut, the psyche, whatever you want to call it.
Right.
And he would write up material based on it. He would go out and he'd perform it. And if it worked, you know, he would tweak it over and over again every night, or, you know, whatever he felt like, oh, maybe this would work better here, or it drags here, or there's no laugh here, or whatever.
Right.
So it was a meticulous process of constant refinement of material, always with the end goal in his mind of, once this is all refined, then I do the HBO special, then I do the comedy album. Once I've gotten all this material that I've written refined down to a fucking science. And so he had that a very scientific approach to comedy. You know, there wasn't a lot of improvisation. There probably wasn't really any, honestly. So there wasn't improv. There wasn't, you know, I'm going to try this new thing on stage night. If there was a new thing being tried on stage, it was because he'd written something new or decided very meticulously and, painstakingly that that's what he was going to do. Like, right down to every, like, little facial expression and delivery and nuance of tone and how long am I going to pause here and this laugh is going to last about 2.3 seconds or whatever the fuck.
So George Clinton was like more of a craftsman. Like he was very meticulous in the way he carried himself and the way these shows were done. So it was like he was just someone that was endlessly preparing to make sure that when he delivered you on stage. I remember he even did that because me and TJ saw George Carlin one time. And he flubbed, like, one thing in this huge line. I think he's basically describing himself like the modern man.
He was doing he was actually doing his suicide bit.
Oh, the suicide bit.
It later got used in, I forget the name of the special. It was his second to last, I think. I forget the exact name of it just now, but he ended up using it there. But he'd gone through about half of the bit, and it just wasn't working for whatever reason. Like, it was actually, we saw his first show of that tour.
Tour, yeah, correct.
He was starting off in Mississippi where we saw him. So the material was all super raw compared to what eventually he performed for his
HBO
album,
special,
his
yeah.
HBO special. And I would say midway through the suicide bit, he just said, eh, this ain't working. Next thing. You know, so we didn't even hear the whole bit.
Yeah, it's like, sorry about that. Just didn't go the way I wanted.
Yeah, he was just like, I need to retool that. He basically just like announced that to us and moved on. So that was interesting to kind of see that process.
Another thing that stood out to me too was some asshole was heckling him. He's like, and he looked at the guy. He's like, is your name on the fucking ticket? No, then shut the fuck up.
Yeah, he was real. Not, I mean, like, a lot of comedians, they try to outwit the hecklers or something. George just basically, like, shouted him down.
He was quick and dirty with it because he wanted to get back on track.
Right.
He had a very planned...
You're distracting me from what I'm fucking trying to do here. Right. Shut your fucking mouth. It was... The guy hadn't even heckled George. He'd heckled the guy that came on before George. So George came out, it's like, I've heard about you. You shut the fuck up. Your name isn't on the ticket. Says George Carlin, not fucking nobody. Fuck you, basically.
It was just a brilliant moment. Just totally shut down the fucking... There was no engagement with the heckler. It was just like, look, you're going to shut your fucking mouth or you're going to get the fuck out of my goddamn show, bitch.
Yep.
But yeah, I mean, like, look, when you talk about Chris Rock, obviously had a shit ton of amazing specials, especially his early shit.
Oh, yeah.
Judd Apatow made some fucking good movies, Superbad, 4-Year-Old Virgin, I don't know what else. Those two really fucking
stick
in my mind.
Did he make Knocked Up?
He was a huge influence on Kevin Smith as well. Yeah, he did make Knocked Up. That was a good one. Huge influence on Kevin Smith, who he didn't even pull, but that's another guy that George Carlin was huge with. And I think Kevin Smith still uses the picture of him and George Carlin as his social media stuff. Just because that was that impactful of a fucking relationship. Ben Stiller, obviously, earlier. And, you know, like, I think that there is some truth to the fucking, the eight generations quote. Maybe not exactly eight.
Right.
But, you know, these older guys, these guys that are way older than me talk about, well, in my childhood, I discovered George Carlin and, you know, it changed the course of my life forever. And I can say that.
I mean, there are definitely
even as someone who's much younger than a lot of those guys saying that.
There are definitely big comedians that had huge careers within the lifespan of George Carlin's career that were hugely influenced by him, that came to prominence and then fell from prominence as he continued to move forward.
Dennis Leary was another one. Dennis Leary talked about the first time he ever wanted to be funny for a living was hearing AM and FM, the album, one of the albums George Carlin put out in 72.
Right.
Speaking of that album, in 72, there was a piece of material on his album Class Clown, which also came out in 72. He actually put out two albums that year. It was called The Seven Words You Can Never Say on Television, often a bridge to The Seven Dirty Words by mainstream media, but George himself never called it that. It was always called The Seven Words You Can Never Say on Television. The words are...
Listen, become a fucking patron, you stupid fuck! What are you waiting for? Huh? Huh? Get up! Grab your credit card! Go over to Patreon and become a patron already! For fuck's sake, what am I gonna do? Spoon feed you epic shit while you lay on your back! You gotta go where the food is! Go! Reach into your wallet. Take out that card. Go to Patreon and swipe that motherfucker and become a real man!
Or a woman.
Or a woman.